Hello, good morning, and welcome. I'm Alec Hogg. It's the 22nd of October, Tuesday, all day. Three very well-informed guests in our studio today. Peter Armitage from Anchor, Stephen Hurwitz from 361, and Peter Major from Modern Corporate Services. But let's kick off first with the news, and here are the headlines from our partners at Bloomberg.
There was no shortage of Fed speak today. The head of the Minneapolis Fed, Neel Kashkari, said he favors reducing rates at a slower pace in the coming quarters, and his sentiment was echoed by the head of the Dallas Fed, Lori Logan. She repeated her call for the Fed to lower rates at a careful pace as the economic environment remains uncertain. At the same time, the head of the Kansas City Fed, Jeffrey Schmid, said he favors a slower pace of rate cuts given uncertainty about how low the Fed should ultimately cut rates. We also heard from the head of the San Francisco Fed, Mary Daly.
So far, I haven't seen any information that would suggest we wouldn't continue to reduce the interest rate. This is a very tight interest rate for an economy that already is on a path to 2% inflation. And I don't want to see the labor market slow further.
That's Mary Daly, the head of the San Francisco Fed, speaking at the Wall Street Journal's Tech Live conference in Laguna Beach, California. Today, the shipping giant A.P. Moller Maersk, a bellwether for global trade, increased its full-year guidance for the fourth time in less than 6 months. The company cited stronger demand along with higher freight rates caused by supply chain disruptions from attacks in the Red Sea. Disney is a step closer to getting some new leadership, the entertainment giant saying today that former Morgan Stanley CEO James Gorman will take over as board chairman next year. Bloomberg media analyst Geeta Raghunathan saying today he brings a lot of credibility, especially when it comes to deciding who will succeed Bob Iger as Disney's next CEO.
You have arguably one of the best executives in the business in James Gorman, who led such a smooth, orderly transition, in his own CEO transition, did it in 5 months with all internal candidates.
That is Bloomberg's Geeta Raghunathan. Shares in Disney today down about 0.7%. The German software giant SAP saying today that cloud revenue was up 25%. The company's clients are shifting from on-premise software to the cloud, so they can access SAP's AI business services. ADRs in SAP up by 3.7% in late U.S. trading.
Well, quite a lot of South African interest in all of that. SAP, of course, the German company that was implicated in corruption around the time of the Gupta leaks. Hasso Plattner, the man who started that company, and I think he's moved out of it now, but he is also the owner of Fancourt here in South Africa. But much more important, as we welcome Peter Armitage from Anchor, is the move on interest rates. And Peter, you've been doing work on the banking sector, and I was just wondering if the banking shares and the work that you've been doing are actually still offering value, given that we're going into a reducing interest rate cycle.
Yeah, I think yesterday we were looking at the banking sector, which is up about 30% off its lows of a few months ago. But almost all of that has come from a change in rating as opposed to a change in forward earnings expectations. So it really is all just about confidence levels improving. On the ground, we're starting to see some benefit coming through from all the good things that are going on. But I think a much more positive vibe, people prepared to employ, people prepared to spend a bit more money. And it's really a confluence of factors. The government of national unity, interest rates are starting to come down. We've seen about 25 billion rand come in from the two-pot retirement system. And we haven't had load shedding for 200 days. So I think, it's really great to feel that way, because the last 6-7 years we've been feeling negative on the SA markets. And I think, like most of the fund managers out there, the confluence of factors coming together now are making for a very powerful cocktail.
If you have a look overseas, and we do take our direction from the United States, they've been powering ahead year to date, The S&P is up 23%. Last week was its sixth consecutive weekly gain. It's almost like what's going on in geopolitics around the world doesn't seem to be scaring investors at all.
Yeah, it's we are starting to get a little bit nervous about, I think the right word is complacency. So when the market's in this kind of mood, there isn't much bad news that that brings it down. And we're starting to, you know, you must also remember that there were, I think, about $6 trillion of money sitting in money market funds. And as rates come down, you know, if you were earning 5.3% in a JP Morgan money market fund, that's now come down to 4.8%. It's going to come down to 3.5% in line with rates, as we were talking earlier. So suddenly people are saying, hold on, I'm not getting rewarded that much. I need to be beating inflation with my investments. So, you know, the equity market becomes more of an option. So I think higher rates in many cases kind of kept people out of equity markets. But we are fairly nervous. Valuations are getting close to the most expensive they've been in 20 years, Alec. So that can't be ignored. You know, we're still keeping clients in their equity portfolios, but with new money, we're deploying it quite cautiously. Because you don't know what the next thing is that can give the market a bit of a correction, but certainly it's priced for perfection. So we really, you know, the market can't afford for anything to go wrong. You can see a quick correction. But, you know, overall, the underlying economies, US economies pumping, and it is ignoring the geopolitical risk because it's assuming that those will not impact the earnings of US companies. I think that's probably the best way to put it.
Also, going back to that fund manager survey, there was a distinct movement from international markets to local markets in recent months by fund managers. But I'm wondering whether you're seeing international investors starting to nibble at South Africa, given everybody knows that America, as you've just articulated, is in high territory, that one should be looking for better value elsewhere. And I guess South Africa must be among them.
Yeah, so quite a bit of money is flowed into the bond market. So over 40 billion rand of foreign money is flowed into the bond market where, and guys have done very well. Bond funds up about 20% this year as bond yields have come down. Bonds are easy because it's just a simple interest rate calculation. Companies are more difficult because there's company fundamentals and, you know, underlying growth in the country. So you haven't seen an en masse entry of foreign investors into the SM market yet. I think they're waiting to see some evidence of the sustainability of the GNU and the impact of all the things that I'm talking about coming through in earnings. And we are at quite a delicate stage in South Africa, where South African fund managers have got confidence because they can look forward. Foreigners are a little bit more skeptical, perhaps. You know, if you think back to the last Ramaphosa episode, share prices have been charging upwards, but nothing really changed on the ground. So I think there's, you know, we think we're leveling off a bit in the SA market. But if we can get another leg and all of the stories that the fund managers are now telling comes to pass and flows through in South African earnings, there can still be quite another big jump. South African shares are still, you know, less than half the price of American shares for the same rand or dollar of earnings. So there is some quite nice upside if it can be sustained.
We are going to have a chat a little later to Stephen Hurwitz of 361 about the announcement coming out of NicePass yesterday, but just your perspective on what's going on at those two companies. It is their 100 days. I've never heard of this before, but I'm sure it can't be the first time that a CEO has, like a politician, brought out their 100-day statement. What did you make of what the CEO of NicePass, the new CEO of NicePass, had to say?
Yeah, I guess it's reminded me a little bit of Joe Biden or President Ramaphosa in terms of putting a target on things. So I think not surprisingly, the message is positive. Talks big picture numbers, saying that you know, that process is worth $100 billion, and he wants to create another $100 billion of value. And the market is kind of looking at it. It's been in the hands of other guys for the last 10 years, and the non-10-cent businesses have been a real disappointment. But they are making some quite nice predictions now. I think they're taking some action. I think NASPAS over the last 5 years was prepared to sit on businesses with an IT mindset going they're going to break even one day. I think they're now looking at those businesses and saying, you know, you're going to make some cash and create the value and give us a business that we can transact with if we want to in the short term. And if you can't make cash in 6 months, you're going to be, do you have a place in our stable? So I think those are the kind of messages that he's sending through. I think the 100-day announcement is always going to be a positive kind of marketing spin. But, you know, they're talking about making $400 million from e-commerce now, where that was making a big loss if you go back 6-12 months ago. But the fact remains that in NASPAS and Prosus, they're trading at about a 40% discount to the sum of their parts, which is a negative vote from the investment market. It's saying that they don't like what they're doing outside of Tencent. And that's really what has to be addressed. And it'll probably take more than another 100 days for the market to be convinced of that.
Well, the whole story of Tencent was in the latest FT News briefing. Not Tencent specifically, but Chinese shares. Let's have a listen.
Share buybacks on China's biggest exchanges have hit a record high this year, about $33 billion in 2024 so far. That's more than double last year's total. Beijing has been pushing companies to return cash to shareholders to help boost China's stock market. It's part of a huge stimulus plan officials have launched to rescue the country's struggling economy. And it seems to be working. The benchmark CSI 300 index has gone up more than 20% over the past month. But the jury's still out on whether the rise in buybacks will solve all of China's economic problems. Third quarter GDP data came in at only 4.6% on Friday. That's below China's all-important 5% target.
Are Tencent buying back shares, Peter? Do you know?
Yeah, they have been. Tencent are sitting in a very cash generative position, making very good money. They're trading at about a forward 16 P multiple. They started focusing on profitability rather than wild turnover growth. I think they're doing all the right things. So the share price has actually done pretty well over the course of the last little while. But NASPAS and prices haven't kept up. You know, that's the bottom line from our perspective.
And another little point that I'd like to pick up on is Disney. There's been a big change there with the new Disney CEO. Let's listen again to the FT's take on it.
Disney is looking to shake things up. The company appointed former Morgan Stanley boss James Gorman as its new chair yesterday. He'll take over the role in 2025. Gorman's main focus will be to find a replacement for longtime chief executive Bob Iger. Gorman wants to have a successor in place by early 2026. Disney has spent basically a decade now trying to find a new CEO. And oh boy, has the saga been popcorn worthy. Iger extended his contract multiple times before stepping aside in 2020. But then he returned to the position in 2022 after his hand-picked successor was unceremoniously ejected from the role. So now we'll be keeping an eye on who's next.
Any thoughts on that one, Peter?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the Disney share price here in front of me. So at the beginning of 2021, it was $200 a share and it's sitting at $100 one, two, three, 4 years later. So, you know, Bob Iger came in as a temporary CEO. He was the CEO years back to kind of rescue a business that had gone through the floor. Disney changed their strategy towards digitization and, effectively launched and put all their efforts behind a Netflix competitor. Netflix has reached a new high, so Disney's still got to kind of get there and prove that its brands can attract the same kind of customers as, and they can make the same sort of business model as a Netflix. But I think, you know, what you see with these big media companies, the CEO and the strategic direction is incredibly important. So having somebody of that stature, I think, is positive. I don't think it's market moving because it's the chairman, you know, that's the actual CEO that the chairman appoints. It's going to be the big one. But Disney's got, you know, its whole media business, its parks business is doing very well. Its travel and entertainment business is doing well. But it's got to start making and convincing the market that its Disney online product presence and subscription is something that's got sustainable growth. And the share price is indicating that the market hasn't decided yet.
Peter Armitage is with Anchor. Thanks for your contribution today, Peter. Look forward to the next time. Well, let's pick up on what's going on in the BRICS summit. That's happening today, starts today in Kazan. That's in Russia. And the real story, according to the international media, is what is going to go down between India and China. Let's have a listen to the way that Bloomberg sees it.
India's top diplomat saying that the Chinese and the Indian governments have reached an agreement to allow patrols to resume on both sides of the border in the Himalayas. That's, of course, where there were clashes between troops from the two countries. We had soldiers die. That precipitated a real downward plunge in relations between the two neighbors, which actually fought a war back in the 60s over the same territory. It seems now that the stage is set for some return to normalcy in that relationship. Heading into the BRICS, the thing that everybody's going to be watching for is if Xi Jinping and Prime Minister Modi are going to have a one-on-one bilateral meeting at that event.
If we do see a warming of that relationship between China and India, what are the broader geopolitical implications, particularly as we're just 2 weeks out from a U.S. election now?
I think they could be quite substantial. Of course, we're still a little bit shy on details at the moment. We don't know if Prime Minister Modi and President Xi will meet, but if that relationship were to strengthen, I think that would undermine to quite a large extent the American effort to try and get India on board as sort of a piece of this containment strategy that's been deployed in Asia. India, of course, is part of the Quad with Australia and Japan and the United States. There has been more tension between the U.S. There have been allegations by both the U.S. and Canada that Indian officials are involved in killings of some separatists in both countries. And of course, this the picture of Xi and Modi meeting at a conference hosted by Vladimir Putin is not going to be one that Washington finds very pleasing.
And of course, at this BRICS summit, we're also watching that ongoing relationship and friendship between Beijing and Moscow as well.
That has been a relationship that has brought a lot of tension, not only to the Chinese relationship with Washington and the United States, but also relations with Europe. China has become the major market for Russian oil. It has been a supplier of many consumer goods. And as the United States has said on many occasions, China, the U.S. believes, is also the major supplier of dual-use technologies to Russia, so things that can be used for both civilian and military purposes. The U.S. has not been shy of sanctioning Chinese companies that it accuses of providing equipment and technology that have helped the Russian war effort.
Well, a warm welcome to Stephen Hurwitz, who's from 361. I guess it's a good segue into the conversation about NASPAS and what we saw yesterday from the new chief executive, his 100-day statement. I asked Peter Armitage a little earlier, Stephen, whether he'd seen one of these before, and he said it reminded him of the politicians. Have you seen this coming through from a CEO, 100 days, and giving some feedback to shareholders as a consequence?
Hi, Alec. Thank you very much. To be honest, no, it's something that's very rare in terms of company feedback to shareholders. I think one of the historical issues that NASPAS has had in the past is that they weren't very friendly in terms of their engagements with various stakeholders. And the new CEO, Fabricio, is trying to address that.
And if you have a look at the content of the statement, Fabricio Bloisi, I guess is the way you pronounce it, is an entrepreneur. He appears to be, however, falling into a little bit of an AI-related trap, boosting the AI story. And I remember during the dot-com boom. Everybody wanted to put, not everybody, but many of the companies put dot-com after their name and immediately got a lift in the share price. Are you impressed by the whole AI relationship?
So I think there's a lot of talk about AI and how it's going to change our lives, but for a lot of people, it's hard to see what the tangible impact is on a day-to-day basis. What is refreshing, though, is that NASPERS has released some case studies where they've actually gone through the examples of what type of AI software implementations they've had at some of their investment companies and how that's improved those companies. So, for example, at both iFood and OLX, they've shown how AI deployments have reduced the amount of fraud in terms of the transactions that have taken place. So these are pretty tangible interventions. I don't think that it's necessarily going to be a huge change in terms of what those companies do, but on the margin, it definitely helps. And I think that being able to automate many of these processes will make the companies more efficient going forward and also improve their profitability.
Stephen, the share price of Prosus was down 1% in South Africa, nearly 0.9% in euros. It certainly wouldn't have been the reaction that the company might have wanted after such a disclosure.
In the case of Naspers and Prosus, the majority of the value is still driven by Tencent, which is their largest investment. It accounts for $120 billion of nearly $150 billion in NAV. So for the time being, a lot of these other things, while they definitely are helpful, they're not going to necessarily dictate the direction of the Naspers and Prosus share price. That's going to be dictated by Tencent. Over the past couple of years, what caused the discount to blow out was poor capital allocation. So hopefully the discount will narrow over time if Fabricio manages to accomplish what he set out to do. But over the short term, it's mostly going to be driven by what happens to Tencent.
Are you feeling as though you can believe the statements that he's making, the projections that he's making, given that Naspers and Prosus are so important in South African portfolios?
I am very optimistic about what Fabricio has planned for the next couple of years. I met him initially after he was appointed as CEO, and it was very refreshing to see someone join the business who had a ton of energy and was very excited about the prospects for the company. But ultimately, as I said earlier, most of the value will be generated by Tencent. And we are cognizant of some of the macroeconomic challenges that China has, as well as some of the geopolitical challenges that are currently taking place, especially if Trump were to be elected as US president.
Yeah, so that would not be a bullish factor, a Trump presidency for this company.
No, probably not.
When you just go a little or dig a little deeper into the numbers, he's talking about the profits or earnings before interest and tax being three times higher for the first half of this year than the year before. That looks pretty impressive, and I guess that it might finally be hitting its straps.
So it is quite easy to triple your profits when it comes off a very small number. So last year it was, I think, just under $30 million. So I think they're targeting about $100 million for the first half of this year. But you'll actually see much bigger growth in the second half, because if they do hit their targets, that implies that the second half will actually grow three times faster than the first half. So finally, the company is starting to look like they're going to be generating free cash flow, which will be a huge positive, because before, the company totally relied on their dividend from Tencent to invest in the rest of the portfolio. And now, for the first time ever, it looks like the rest of the portfolio is also going to be contributing positively.
That's an interesting point. The investments that it's made with the money that came in from Tencent are now starting to themselves generate cash. One of those investments is Takealot here in South Africa. And reading through the details of the statement, it appears as though Naspers is fully supportive of Takealot, and we continue to invest in this loss-making operation despite the entry here of Amazon. What do you think its chances are of winning that?
I think that Takealot does have a pretty dominant position in the South African market on the e-commerce side. Amazon, while it has launched here, it has been somewhat underwhelming, although that may change in time. It's never good for a company to underestimate the competition. I think what's a much bigger issue for the likes of Takealot in South Africa is actually Temu, which is very difficult for them to compete with, especially on the cost side.
Yeah, it's a little bit like what we're seeing with BRICS now. The reports coming out of BRICS, the people on the ground there, is that BRICS could have a much bigger economy than the G7 come 2030, for instance, or at least that's what they're projecting. And here you mentioned Temu, which is quite a concern, or should be a concern for Takealot. But the attention of most observers, other observers, is, well, Amazon's the one to watch out for. So I guess it's just kind of different strokes for different folks, isn't it? But would you, Stephen, be buying the shares? And I ask this because we do have Prosus in the BizNews model portfolios. It's done pretty well for us so far. And in fact, the share price is up in euros by nearly 50% this year. So it's had a good run. Would you be buying into it now, or are you expecting something different?
So while we do like the long-term fundamentals of Naspers and Prosus, and we continue to hold them in our own portfolios at 361, for someone who's looking at buying the companies, I would probably wait until some clarity on the US election. Maybe you get a better entry point if Donald Trump is elected.
Last issue that I'd like to pick up with you, and we had an article, we had a interview last week with Cedric Sewell, who is the legal counsel for Turkcell. Now, it seems as though the fight between Turkcell, which is claiming that it was cheated out of the Iranian cell phone license by MTN, has gone a bit on the back burner. Is it MTN a company that you pay attention to personally?
So we do monitor MTN, and we have invested in it from time to time. I think that if you have a look at these cases, they take years and years to work their way through legal systems. And I think that we're not going to get any clarity on that for a long period of time. The biggest issue at the moment for MTN, however, is their operations in Nigeria. That country seen its currency devalue massively, and it was one of the largest profit drivers for MTN. So until you see some stability out of Nigeria, which may come now that Dangote's launched his refinery there, and they'll be less reliant on refined fuel product imports, you could see a stabilization in the currency, but not one of my preferred companies, let me put it that way.
Well, I'd like you just to listen in on this conversation. It's a highlight of an interview that Chris Stein had with Cedric Sewell, who's the Turkcell legal counsel.
In 2003, Iran puts out a tender for a GSM network in Iran. It's a huge opportunity because it's, at the time, it's a territory of some 70 million people, most of which don't have cell phones. So it's a really exciting opportunity. Turkcell, the Turkish telecoms company that I represent, puts in a bid. MTN puts in a bid, and Turkcell wins. And so Turkcell starts doing what is necessary to move the process along and finalize the license and get the license. And our allegations are that while Turkcell is doing this with the Iranian authorities, MTN, not happy with having been a runner-up, decides to meddle and inserts himself in these negotiations by secretly talking to the Iranian authorities, promising all kinds of things. We say they promised weapons, sort of introductions to weapons companies. They promised to lobby the South African government so that the South African government would take a different position on Iran's nuclear program. And we also allege that MTN paid Iranian and South African authorities bribes. And all of this led to Iran essentially kicking Turkcell out and giving the license to MTN.
Crazy stuff, isn't it? And then you overlay that what's going on in the Middle East and the whole BRICS summit today, where Iran is now a member of BRICS, has been introduced into it. And I guess you've just got to look at geopolitics when you're making investments. You cannot ignore it, as might have happened decades ago, when, or even a decade ago, when it was really Pax Americana.
There's definitely been a fracturing in terms of the global geopolitical order. However, it's quite easy to get caught up in terms of some of these geopolitical headlines. And I would just say that the best way still for investors to make money is actually focus on the bottom up and focus on company fundamentals, because it's quite easy to get swayed by day-to-day news headlines. And if you find good companies, they tend to do well regardless of what's going on in the rest of the world.
Stephen Hurwitz is with 361, and we'll be talking in just a moment to someone else about BRICS. That's Peter Major, who is our go-to man on mining. Stephen giving us some insights there on Naspers and indeed on how to keep your head when those about you are losing theirs on geopolitics. Well, one of the stocks that we do have in the BizNews portfolios that's done terribly well for us is Uber. And Uber appears to be going in a different direction. Once again, here's our colleagues at the, or our partners at the Financial Times of London, with some very interesting developments that came out from Uber this week.
Uber is thinking about buying the travel and booking site Expedia. That would be the company's largest deal ever and get it closer to super app status. The FT's Stephen Morris is here to explain how Uber plans to go from humble ride-hailing startup to multi-purpose behemoth. Hey, Stephen.
Hi.
So to start, can you just explain this concept of a super app a bit more?
Sure. A super app is sort of a one-stop shop for all of your online purchasing life. I mean, you're seeing these dominate in China. The most notable one is WeChat, which started as a chat platform but expanded out into payments and shopping. And whilst Uber doesn't quite have ambitions on that grand a scale yet, what it wants to do is be the app that you click on when you want to travel anywhere or have anything delivered.
Okay, so Uber wants to become something of a super app-light kind of thing. How does Expedia help it get there?
Well, as most people will be aware, Uber started as a ride-hailing technology, you know, basically linking up people that wanted to get somewhere with someone willing to drive them. But in recent years, it's expanded into other areas such as corporate and business logistics, food delivery, as a lot of people will know, and it has much wider ambitions. The chief executive, his name is Dara, he says, anywhere you want to go in your city and anything that you want to get, we want to empower you to do so. Now, Uber is in a good position at the moment. Its shares are on a bit of a tear at the moment, and it's now worth $173 billion. So it's thinking about what to do with the cash to kind of enshrine its position and add more features to its super app. And one of the logical things to get into are things like plane bookings, train bookings, hotel bookings. So that's why Expedia would be attractive, as Uber looks what to do with its newfound wealth from its much higher stock price.
Now, where do things stand with this possible acquisition? I mean, do you think it's actually going to go through?
We heard about this quite early on and reported it. Basically, because of the Uber chief executive Dara's history, serving as Expedia CEO from 2005 to 2017, and the fact that he's still a board member, it makes it legally tricky, because obviously he's privy to inside strategic and financial information as a board member. So what Uber has done is it's got bankers and lawyers and consultants to kind of look at whether it would even be possible from a corporate governance perspective, and then furthermore to look at what price it would be. So I think while this deal may not transpire, it kind of shows that Uber is on the hunt. Uber wants to continue expanding and it's willing to buy things rather than just grow organically.
And so what would it mean for the tech sector more broadly if Uber is able to actually achieve a sort of super app status?
Well, Uber is kind of emerging as one of the champions with a more sustainable business model, showing its first full year of profitability recently. But if it is able to take the next step, we could see its valuation, you know, increase by multiples of what it is today. And if it does start getting genuinely into new areas like payments and advertising, it could challenge some of the existing giants like Visa and MasterCard. But also you're looking at Google and Meta and all the other big ad-driven tech companies.
Stephen Morris is the FT San Francisco Bureau Chief. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
Fascinating insights there on Uber. And as I said earlier, one of the better performing stocks in the BizNews portfolio. Well, one we've added recently is Anglo American. And it was interesting this week talking to Bernard Swanepoel, who was full of praise for Duncan Wanblad, the chief executive of Anglo. And he reckons this is going to be a top company, perhaps even dominate its sector into the future. Got a long way to go. Peter Major joins us now. Pete, are you as positive about Anglo American as Bernard is? And, you know, we want to see the stock doing something in the BizNews model portfolios.
No, I'm not as positive as Bernard, but I am positive, Alec. I think the guys have been way too harsh on Anglos and on Duncan. And it brings back memories of Tony Traer. And, you know, Tony Traer was conservative. He sort of missed the initial boom. And what did he do? Nothing. And that's what a good fund manager should do. If you think you missed something, but you're not quite sure, do nothing. So he didn't do anything. And Cynthia Carroll took over and she immediately started buying a whole bunch of assets. Then you had the great big correction. And had Tony Traer still been in power then, which is only a year and a half, 2 years later, geez, Anglos would have been choking on cash. All the mining houses and companies fell 70, 80%. He could have bought anything he wanted for 20 cents on the buck. So Duncan's not quite in that position, but he's in a good position. Anglos is in good shape. They've always had great assets, and there's no need to panic. And sure, he speeded things up or tried to, but you know what? If Billiton wants to offer a crazy price, that's up to the shareholders to accept. I'll be sad to see it go. But Billiton's got to worry more about how are they going to grow other than just taking over Anglos at a premium.
just unpack that for us. Billiton did have a go at Anglo American. They were rebuffed. When are they able to have another go?
I think as of right now, or let me check, Alec, it could be the end of the month. That'd be quite a coincidence that from Halloween on, they can now buy it again or make an offer again. and I think one of the reasons we admitted it's worth them looking at this is it is so indeterminate and difficult to plan to build a new mine. You know, with governments just getting increasingly more difficult, legislation changing all the time, social and labor, it's not getting easier. It's getting more complicated and difficult. So that's what's delaying. It's not just the technical. It's all that extracurricular activity. You're lucky to build a mine 10 years after you want to build it. And from initial discovery to building it, you're looking at closer to 20 years. So companies say, hell, I'd rather pay a premium. I'm bullish on this metal. But that's not how a good fund manager would do it. You know, a good fund manager tries to be a little bit more scientific, go back to Warren Buffett. I want to buy things that are knocked down. I want to buy things at a discount so I got some margin of safety. And we know from experience, 8 out of 10 acquisitions are total disasters. 1 out of 10 probably breaks even, and 1 out of 10 you make money on. So the odds are they're not going to really score the shareholders by paying a premium for Anglo American.
Despite that surge in the Anglo share price when Billiton or BHP Billiton made its offer, and then the subsequent decline as that offer left the table, the shares are still up 20% in pound terms this year. So being a good fund manager, How would you look at this? Would you look at it as a buy opportunity or wait for a bit later?
I always try and fine-tune it, which often doesn't work. It squeezes out from me. I think it's a weak to moderate buy here. I think if a guy buys here 3, 4, 5 years later, he will have beat the all-share index. So it's not a bad buy here. I've seen it down at 500 Rand. I think that's a great buy. It's now, what, 560? So that's only up 10 or 12%. I wouldn't be paying much over the current price for it. But resources in general are really pounded down, Alec. Our all-share index has only been this low relative to the S&P twice in the history of man. So does history repeat itself? If it doesn't, it rhymes very similar. So our all-share does look really, really cheap here on a P basis. And Anglo's looks pretty cheap here relative to our all-share. And it's got a nice broad asset base. It's got good management. It's got a great CEO, I feel. So I would be full Anglo's. You know, what's market rating? Market weighting. Yeah, it's not a bad buy here. Billiton looks even cheaper. You know, because people are afraid it's going to overpay for assets because it's out there trying to overpay for assets. So Billiton, I think it's mainly just riding down the iron ore curve. You know, the majority of its profits come from iron ore, and iron ore is about a 5-year low now. There's excess steel floating around. China looks like it's finally done all its big building, and now it's exporting excess steel. So I think that's one of the main reasons Billiton's trading so low. But both Billiton and Anglo's, the whole resource sector, is quite bombed out because it's not flavor of the month or flavor of the year. Everything else is. You can see New York is actually selling resources in order to buy all this new tech. And I think that's a little bit overdone. I think we're looking a bit like 2000. You know, we're due for a correction on all this new wave, new era stuff. So, yeah, I'm a resource guy. That doesn't mean I always want to buy it. But just on all the historicals, resources other than gold are looking pretty good value now.
I'll pick you up on gold in a moment. But there is the BRICS summit today. So using a little bit of perhaps lateral thinking, if the Americans don't want to buy resources, and particularly South African resources, might we see the BRICS countries starting to take an interest? China needs resources for its own industrial engine, and as the politicians get a bit closer, you get the sense, particularly because China's business is very strongly supported or even owned by the Chinese government, that there might be an alternative to BHP Billiton in as an Anglo suitor. What's your thought on that?
I don't know, Alec. Strategically, if you think like a warlord and you want to invade or take over other countries, yeah, you'd always go for the resources. You'd go for the oil, the gas, the timber, the water. And then that means you got to take over the land, which means you actually have to take over the whole country. So we always hear about, oh, these are strategic. You know, South African government loves using the word strategic. It really means, is there a chance they can get their fingers on some of the crumbs? But yeah, what's strategic in this world? I think it's been way, way overdone, oversold. Resources are distributed pretty evenly all over the world. So who's really got a monopoly on oil? Who's really got a monopoly on gold, on gas, on timber? So we hear China's busy investing all over Africa, wants to secure these assets. Well, who's withheld things from China anyways in the last 50 years, if not longer? You know, China could always get iron ore from somebody. They could always get the metals from somebody. They could always get gas and oil. Just look at the way Russia's got pretty extensive sanctions put on them since they invaded Ukraine. And yet, yeah, they're having to sell at a bit of a discount, but they're selling all their oil, all their gas, all their minerals. And each day, week, month that goes by, they're selling them at less of a discount. So I'll tell you what, I'm a little bit influenced by some of these new era presentations going around. I was at the business school Alumni Weekend, and they had Anton Musgrave presenting after lunch when you need people to wake up. Well, that was the guy to present. He just went through slide after slide and showed us and summarized what is going on in the world, how it is changing so quick. If you're trying to be number one, you're already too late. You have to be number uno, period. In other words, don't try and be number one in your industry. Just try and be leading an industry that doesn't even exist yet. And that's kind of how the rest of the things went. So I think these long-range scenario planning forecasts, oh, we're going to structure like this or that, I think the world is too dynamic and shifting under one's feet that you don't want to have a big corporation put too much effort, time, and money into setting up what they think is going to be the future business. It just changes too much, and you're just like a dinosaur. You're feet of clay. So, yeah, I'm not sure what's going to come out of this BRICS. You know, the bigger it gets, fine, pretty soon the whole world will be in it, and the States is going to be knocking on the door saying, hey, can we have a role here too? You know, we're individual countries and companies. Let's just do what's best for us. Let's use what currency works for us, and let's join every organization that'll have us in that we think we can benefit from.
That's a little bit like the subtext to the South African relationship, but it's nice to be one of the five founders, I guess, of BRICS. A big South African company that's really cheap at the moment, if you look at it historically, is Sasol. I'm not sure if this is one you'd pay a lot of attention to, Peter, but I know our community are either invested or interested in investing in it. So perhaps you can give us some thoughts on what you think of Sasol right now, given it certainly isn't overpriced.
No, it's not overpriced, but Sasol is as much a victim as the new South African government as it is to the worldwide changing events. And some of those changing events are trying to clean up the environment, which means oil from coal is not a big plus. But its oil from gas technology was world leading, and it was making an effort to get involved in that internationally. It is making an effort to diversify internationally, because as we've seen, anybody staying in this country is just subject to so much shifting of regulations, policy, bad infrastructure, moody, temperamental government decisions, short-sighted decisions. You know, it is virtually suicide to have all your assets in this country. It's really close to corporate suicide. Warren Buffett's always bragged up the virtues of diversification. Now, that doesn't mean willy-nilly run out and just buy stuff. So poor Sasol, they are subject to a lot of the troubles that other local companies have, and they've got the ESG coming against them, because environmentally, geez, they were right at the top of the list. But you'd think they had decades of pretty good management, decades of real innovative breakthroughs. And boy, they built things that people were talking about. They built things that very few people could even imagine. So they had that capability. I don't know how much they've lost it. I don't want to put them in the ISCOR category yet. You know, ISCOR was one of our eight big mining houses here at one time. And government, although they had a big role in forming it back in 1928, nurturing it, helping it come up, it was a regional powerhouse. You know, it was Africa's biggest steel maker by far. We can see ISCOR's they've not benefited from the new government at all. They've taken as much pain as all of our big corporates. Now government comes in and it offers them a couple pieces of candy here and there, trying to help them. But that just shows what bad policy can do. And yeah, Sasol looks cheap. ISCOR looks cheap, but why are things going to change? Why are things going to make it go up? You know, it's still pretty much functional on the oil price, its share price. And look at oil. It's down here at $74. You know, it's at its long-term average if you're comparing it to Brent spot. You know, long-term average, that's an 80-year average, and oil's just sitting here. So it's hard to see Sasol going up without the energy prices going up, and I don't see that happening. You know, there's plenty of coal, plenty of oil, plenty of natural gas. So I would say you got to be a pretty active fund manager to be buying Sasol, and there's a lot of them out there, but it's not a Warren Buffett buy and put away long-term hold like most of his companies.
Mm. Okay, we did promise to close off or to quiz you on gold. I know Kruger Rands have been a phenomenal investment for South Africans because of their rand content as well as the gold content. But you, I picked up that you're not that excited about gold right now, looking forward.
No, I'm not. It looks like one of those flagpole formations. And it's great. You know, it's great for the country, even though we've closed down 80% of our gold mines. You know, at least the 15% that are still open are generating profits. It's the sector that really needs it. And I don't believe there is another sector in this economy ever that had such spin-offs that generated so much good for so many people. Because just take the example, they would go out and they'd find gold mine in the Orange Free State. And there's nothing but a couple farms there. And before you know it, you got little shops around the shaft sinking crew. Before you know it, you got a highway that's paved. Before you know it, there's a railroad. Then there's a warehouse. Then there's a town. Then there's a city. And you just look at all the subsidiary industries that formed around each gold mine, each and every gold mine. And so it's great for South Africa, this price. And at least Harmony Gold and our few remaining gold mines are open. They are capitalizing on it. They're doing much-needed capex. I'm worried that they're looking at putting some of the money offshore because the things they're buying, I don't believe, are cheap. I won't say they're great quality because they would have been grabbed. So if they can just be cautious with the money. And when we had this gold price run in the 70s, geez, we'd endured decades of low gold prices. So our mines were very efficient. We were the lowest cost producer on the planet. We put most of the world out of business in gold mining. So when the 70s gold price took off, we were ready for it. And we had a good tax formula that meant if you put the money back in the ground, you save a lot on tax, you know, rather than just handing it over. And that's what the mines did. And all that money they put back into the ground, it helped the communities, the people, the cities, the national government. And that's what got them through all the low gold prices of the 80s and 90s, was all that money they put back into the ground. And it's just devastating that we had such a horrible change in policy that we nationalized the mines and we did everything to drive those mines to stop investing and to close. We even assisted them in closing. You know, it should be easy to open a mine. It should be impossible to close a mine, and our legislation and policies reverse that. We make it impossible to open a mine and real easy to close. So I have no doubt the ANC likes to brag they were trained in Russia. I have no doubt they were trained in Russia because, boy, everything they've done is what a saboteur would do. So am I positive on gold? No, I think it's run too much. It's even kicking butt on cryptocurrencies. You know, the last 5 or 6 years, they're trading positions. Who's performed best this month, this year? I think it's overdone, but it is reflecting the whole world is printing money like never before. And China and America are the two big leaders. So whether we have a BRICS currency or you stay with the Western dollar and pound, it doesn't matter. Both sides are printing funny money left and right. And you look at the candidates running for office in America, well, gold's discounting them because neither of them's talking about the economy. Each of them's just talking about printing money, cutting taxes, spending money where you don't have it. So it's a pretty safe bet. Whoever wins the election in America is probably going to be good for gold. But I would be taking profits if I made some in gold now. I would be diversifying into something that looks much, much less sexy and appealing. I just think it's too overdone.
And what would that be, Peter? What would be your diversification alternative?
It would probably be mining houses. It would probably be Billiton and Anglos, Alec, because I think they have great assets. I think they have good management. And if anything, I don't think they're diversified enough. I think Billiton was a little too reliant on iron ore. It's trying to diversify into phosphate. But yeah, they look pretty good investments. I would be taking money out of precious metal investments right now. Although I say precious metal, let's say gold, because even the platinums have come back quite a bit and don't look like bad value. But those PGM prices are still pretty high. You know, platinum is trading at its long-term average right now. It's not bombed out. Palladium is trading still a lot higher than its long-term average. Rhodium's trading a lot higher. So I don't even think platinum's cheap. It's just fallen a long ways. But I think for safety's sakes, the way the world looks now, yeah, I'd want most of my assets in the mining houses or in the Aussie.
Peter Major, Director of Mining at Modern Corporate Solutions, and I'm Alec Hogg. It's been a real pleasure having that masterclass from Pete on what's going on in resources, commodities, and investing generally. Well, this has been your BizNews Briefing, and we'll be back again, same time, same place tomorrow. Until then, cheerio.